Hello, and welcome to the Radical Thoughts Podcast. In this bonus episode, I interview Adrian Johnston to talk a little bit more about Slavoj Žižek, Lacanian psychoanalysis, and theories of materialism. This is a follow-up episode to our discussion of Slavoj Žižek's The Metastases of Enjoyment. So you might want to listen a little bit to that episode if you haven't already to understand what I'm asking and what I'm discussing with Johnston. Right now, you're listening to 22 Ghosts 3 by Nine Inch Nails, but soon you'll be listening to our interview. Hello, listeners. I am here today with Adrian Johnston, who is a Žižek scholar who has worked on psychoanalysis and has attempted to tie psychoanalysis to neurobiology, which I find pretty fascinating. And he's in the Department of Philosophy at the University of New Mexico. So, Adrian, thank you so much for agreeing to come on and talk about this this kind of odd Žižek book that we read.
Well, thank you for having me.
So I'm glad that you agreed to come on and talk about this, partially because the book we read is a little bit obscure for a Žižek text. It's certainly not one that I was super familiar with or had heard a lot about compared to, you know, The Sublime Object or Absolute Recoil, or maybe They Know Not What They Do, or something like some of those kind of more popular ones. Or it's certainly not as easy to digest as, say, The Pervert's Guide to Ideology. So I was curious if you're at all really familiar with this particular work, given that you've engaged with a lot of Žižek's over your scholarly work, and if you think that it has an important place in what he's trying to do.
Well, yes, and in fact, this book first appeared in English in 1994, although portions of it had been published initially in French in a book from 1990, whose title was, you know, what we would translate as For They Know Not What They Do. It's a volume that looks like this. It was recently, this is the original, it was recently reissued by Presse Universitaire de France. But it is this period in Žižek's intellectual itinerary, you know, from the early through late 90s, roughly that decade, most of his works were, you know, quite, you know, tightly focused on what is still the main center of gravity of his philosophical interest, namely the intersection between German idealism on the one hand and psychoanalysis, particularly Lacanian psychoanalysis on the other. When I was a graduate student in the 90s, it was this Žižek who I really fell in love with, that I already was invested in psychoanalysis and was studying, among other things, German idealism as a doctoral student. Žižek's work from this period just, you know, immediately grabbed me. And, he's remained a lasting source of inspiration since. You know, if you look at the books that he was publishing in the 90s, most of them are much more philosophical than his, at this point, by comparison, significantly more popular texts. I think that really part of what happened is, I mean, he always, of course, had interests in politics, popular culture, et cetera, and that he does, even in his very philosophical writings, have recourse to examples drawn from those domains, so as to show us that figures like Hegel and Lacan, even though they initially seem hopelessly abstract and far removed from the nitty-gritty texture of our daily experience, that no, in fact, what they are talking about, you know, indeed is incarnate, is writ large, you know, across, you know, the full arc of our daily experiences. And, you know, so he's bringing to life, you know, various and sundry philosophical and psychoanalytic concepts that initially might seem abstract to the point of lifeless relative to our quotidian reality. But nonetheless, I think that part of what happened with him is that, especially at the beginning of the 21st century, as you know, you might say the American holiday of history was brought to an end by things like 9/11, that he was, he really felt compelled to become, to really come into his own as, not just an academic theoretician, but as a public intellectual. I was witnessing this change happen even in New York. I was, living in New York, graduate school. Slavoj would come to the city several times a year. And when he would give talks in the 90s in New York, there would be maybe 20 or 30 people in a small room, in a Soho art gallery listening to him. And then, right after 9/11, his talk started drawing just, huge crowds that the, New York City Police Department had to disperse, et cetera. And I think, he's now become very famous, mainly thanks to his, quite accessible, but still grounded in his theoretical framework, interventions with respect to current events and, various and sundry social, political, cultural phenomena. The Žižek who I love most, and I think, the part of himself he loves most is the more strictly philosophical, theoretical writer. And in fact, one of his favorite books is from a year before Metastases of Enjoyment, is 1993's Tearing with the Negative. And that is very focused on the Cartesian cogito as it is reworked by the German idealists, especially Kant and Hegel, and then as it informs the Lacanian theory of subjectivity. And for him, that was one of his best pieces of work. And I see Metastases of Enjoyment as situated more in that line, right? But what I think is unique about it, sorry if it's taking me a long time to get around to talking about that book, that book in particular. I think what's most valuable about Metastases of Enjoyment is what Žižek does by looking at the intersections between Marxism on the one hand and psychoanalysis on the other. And in particular, the early portions of it, where he, from a Lacanian standpoint, revisits the legacy of the Frankfurt School and the manner in which figures such as, Adorno and Marcuse addressed psychoanalysis from a certain sort of Marxist standpoint. The Frankfurt School and Lacanianism, here you have this major missed encounter in the 20th century. Lacan, you'll find no references to figures like Adorno or Marcuse at all in Lacan's vast corpus. Although we do know that recently a friend of mine, a Lacan scholar in France, Juan Pablo Lucelli, was able to confirm that some of Lacan's work from the 1930s, in which he talked about Western civilization undergoing a quote-unquote social decline of the paternal imago, that this idea of the collapse of a traditional form of patriarchy, Lacan actually was inspired by Horkheimer for this particular claim. But otherwise, really just two ships passing in the night. And it's really shocking because, of course, the Frankfurt School theoreticians have this sophisticated engagement with psychoanalysis. And Lacan is himself also has a very intricate, nuanced relationship to Marxism. But Lacan's Marxism was based on a selective reading of some bits of Marx himself, a little Lenin, and then what he was soaking up with, from his French contemporaries, especially figures like Althusser, the later Sartre. And so Žižek bringing these two parties into conversation, that's the most memorable portion of Metastases of Enjoyment for me. And I have to confess, I haven't read it since the 90s. So it's been a long while. But that work that he's doing at the crossroads between those two orientations and the implications for, not just Freudo-Marxism, but what would a Lacano-Marxism look like? I think Žižek makes some very important moves along those lines initially in this book from 94.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mention like that early rich, early section, because I also thought that was, and I mean, I'm biased too, because it's like, oh, he's talking about the Frankfurt School, like I like this stuff, but I was really interested in the way that he frames it, in part because he kind of does this argument that if someone has maybe the more like the way that I first encountered the Frankfurt School in undergrad, where it was like, oh, these are cultural theorists. They're talking about culture. They're talking about the media. The way that he frames it is kind of interesting because he sort of takes that and he sort of breaks down. He says, they're not really talking on the level of culture in the way that people imagine it to usually mean, because like the whole level of the kind of psychoanalytic analysis to him, it's like the level of the unconscious and the necessity of like drive and stuff cannot be found. To put it at the level of culture, he says, kind of relegates it to the, I don't remember the terms, but the humanist or kind of reformist psychoanalysts, like later Fromm, that it relegates everything back to the ego because it becomes just a issue of self-alienation as opposed to cultural values that don't like that don't mesh with my personal values, mesh with my desire to be an unalienated individual. But Zizek, and I would presume the Lacanian tradition, says that doesn't really work if you don't have the level of the unconscious, if you don't have that kind of beyond the ego conflict going on. I thought that that was a particularly interesting interjection to make, because it certainly is very easy to pick up the Frankfurt School, or even with Zizek, just because he does so much talking about film, you might think, oh, he's just talking about culture. He's just talking about, you know, the culture industry or on that level. What do you have to say about that kind of conflict? Clearly, I think that there is an implication about what we might call culture in that, but it's not about an analysis of culture per se. It's not really a question, but if you have anything you want to spin off on that with.
Well, actually, a number of things, because there's a whole array of interesting issues you've just put on the table. And where I'll begin is that, you know, one of the things you mentioned is another reason why the lack of interaction between the early Frankfurt School and Lacan is even more striking, in that they shared a common enemy, namely this form of post-Freudianism that is, you know, was championed first and foremost by the founding figures of Anglo-American ego psychology. And so you have really the grandmother of ego psychology was none other than Anna Freud, Freud's daughter, who, you know, starting in the 1930s, you know, began laying the theoretical foundations that were then taken over by a troika that really established ego psychology as a distinct orientation unto itself. And that would be Hartmann, Criss, and Lowenstein, who were responsible for really cementing in place ego psychology, properly speaking. And, you know, of course, the ego psychologists were, you know, really Lacan's main enemies within the international psychoanalytic movement, and that, you know, much of his work, especially in the 1950s, but his polemics against ego psychology persist well into his later years in for instance, the seminars of the 70s, a lot of Lacan's work is devoted to attacking ego psychology as an utter betrayal of the foundations of psychoanalysis a la Freud, even though it is, you know, it claims to be, it makes assertions for itself of being a scientific, systematized Freudianism. But for Lacan, it is, you know, it's not only a deviation, it's just an outright betrayal of the core components of psychoanalysis as Lacan understands them. And when Lacan talks about conducting a quote-unquote return to Freud beginning in the 1950s, it's this rescue operation trying to extract from Freud those elements that are central to psychoanalysis and, you know, are arguably marginalized or even denied by Freud's supposed heirs and successors. And one of Lacan's criticisms of the ego psychologists, even before Lacan becomes more engaged with Marxism for various reasons beginning in the 60s, is that, you know, for him, ego psychology, especially once the ego psychologists fled the European continent thanks to World War II and the Nazis, and then relocated to the Western Hemisphere, and, you know, many of them settled in the United States, and Lacan sees them as immediately setting about trying to sell themselves to their their new American compatriots, and, you know, essentially embracing the ideology of Anglo-American capitalism and all that goes along with that. And Lacan argued that essentially the ego psychologists turn themselves into agents for indoctrinating their analysons into this ideological universe of in particular American capitalism. And so he derides the ego psychologist consulting rooms as essentially, factories for, as Chomsky would put it, manufacturing consent, creating these healthy, well-adapted, married, two mm-hmm. kids, two cars in the garage, white picket fence, conformists. And likewise, when you read, and this is so striking, when you read someone like Marcuse, and he talks about these, Freudian or pseudo-Freudian revisionists, he's talking about the same people. So they have these shared enemies and this shared critique of a psychoanalysis that betrays its core elements so as to adapt itself to, what is demanded of persons by a capitalist ideological universe. So that's one thing. So yeah, the Zizek, points out through references to this historian named Russell Jacoby, and these references pop up in Metastases of Enjoyment. And one of the things that Jacoby's historical work has done is look at how psychoanalysis in its early years had a pronounced radical wing, and that if you look at, for instance, in the Western context, early figures in the 30s and 40s like Wilhelm Reich and Otto Fenichel, they were already trying to forge a shotgun marriage between Marx and Freud. They were laboring on a combination of psychoanalytic metapsychology with historical materialism in particular. And similarly, and at roughly the same time, in the pre-Stalinist Soviet context, you had major figures like Vygotsky and Luria, who were also trying to find ways to integrate psychoanalysis and historical materialism, and even dialectic with the Soviets, with dialectical materialism to boot, with psychoanalysis. So, but a lot of that, in the Soviet context, of course, Stalinism with its condemnation of psychoanalysis, snuffed out among so many other things, this work that people like Luria and Vygotsky were doing at the intersection of Freudianism and Marxism, within Western psychoanalysis, there was this, essentially ego psychology writing out of the history of psychoanalysis as much more leftist, radical side to the history of analysis in its earlier 20th century phases. So there's all of that, which is, very interesting to look at. Now this is a tricky issue, especially with the Frankfurt School, because, within certain Marxist currents, there are frequent complaints that I think are not without some justification, that one of the problems with the Frankfurt School, which you already have, in terms of when you look at the foundations of Western Marxism with figures like the young Lukács or Gramsci, is that that Western Marxism, looking at both earlier stages of Western Marxism, a la the First and Second Internationals, at aspects of Engels's work, and then, of course, the Soviet, particularly Stalinist version of historical materialism, there was this anxiety that aspects of Marxism had gone too far in the direction of a kind of economic reductionism and wanting to say, well, ultimately, culture, politics, religion, philosophy, ideology, all of it can be seen as ultimately explained by the historical unfolding of a given mode of production, that the material base of the economic infrastructure is the ultimate causal nexus, of everything which we would want to account for. This concern that there are both theoretical and practical political problems with this kind of reductive economism that figures like Lukács, Gramsci, et cetera, push back against. But it's as though with Western Marxism, including, a lot of what is involved in the Frankfurt School, it's as though the pendulum swung so far away from economism that it's almost as though you know, keeping an eye on the task of critique of political economy that was, of course, the central obsession of the mature Marx, kind of dropped out of view. Marxism in the Western world really stopped keeping abreast of developments in the economy and economics. And a lot of it seemed to then turn into with this idea of, well, we can now reassert the at least relative autonomy of superstructure, including culture, and we can engage in cultural analysis without constantly having to ground it in the economy, et cetera. It's as though, you know, Marx was almost replaced by another figure who was important to the Frankfurt School, Max Weber. And, you know, the sense of, well, economy is just one factor among many in terms of accounting for various sociocultural phenomena. And, you know, there's the danger that you move so far away from Marx that you cease to have something which is recognizably Marxist in terms of saying, well, there are reasons for saying that the economy, even if it's not all determining, enjoys perhaps greater weight or more importance than other factors, especially in capitalist societies. You know, and Zizek, both Zizek and myself, you know, in recent years have, I think, you know, become increasingly dissatisfied with that side of the Western Marxist tradition in the 20th century, in the sense that much has been lost by this neglect of the economy in the name of avoiding, you know, trying to fend off the danger of economic reductionism. So, you know, but of course, at the same time with the Frankfurt School, it's tricky because they are well aware that, well, if you're a Marxist as a historical materialist, then culture is never just simply culture. Culture is going to be a kind of outgrowth, reflection, manifestation, sort of, you know, coded expression of things that have to do with class conflict, with the material base of society as the economic infrastructure, et cetera. You know, and, you know, with Zizek, yeah, I mean, he also, on the one hand, he is very much, as a Marxist, in line with the 20th century Western Marxist tradition of placing a premium on, you know, Marx-informed cultural analysis. With him too, you have the added factor, which you already had with the Freudo-Marxism of a figure like, you know, Marcuse, of indicating that Marxism by itself is not enough to do justice to everything we could say about culture. You need, you know, the psychoanalytic concepts and sensibilities to get at some of this as well. And there are various ways to do that. And we could go into the details of that if you want. But for now, you know, just suffice it to say that, yeah, there's a sense of, in order to do justice to culture, you need not only historical materialism, you also need analytic metapsychology. But yeah, the notion that there's some sort of domain of culture that is entirely independent of the forces and factors that both Marxism and Freudianism/Lacanianism posit. Yeah, I mean, Zizek would, of course, be opposed to, you know, treating culture as this sort of hermetically sealed, you know, domain unto itself.
That's maybe a good place to move in the direction of a little bit about how Zizek and your kind of borrowing from Zizek, your work is pretty interested in kind of reconceptualizing or complicating kind of the realm of materialism itself as like this, you know, what does it mean to be a materialist, especially, I think, after this kind of move in the 60s and 70s where even figures who are attempting to leap behind the reductionism of the Soviet Union, even someone like Althusser, you can kind of get into a materialism that again does this, oh, there's no agency. It's, you know, the material factors, it's kind of like atoms just bouncing off one another or something like that. With Zizek's work, his use of psychoanalysis, and I would presume some of what you're taking and using in your own engagement with kind of French high theory, you might say, in psychoanalysis, it's kind of that question of like, what is subjectivity and agency within the realm of materialism per se, which I think relates again to that kind of question of if you have an economic kind of like materialism, but then you also have to account for the expressions and the ways that there's, you know, communications and things happening that organize and orient it, that isn't just the pure reproduction at the level of, you know, the immediate process of production or what have you. I think a lot of Marxists who, even if they're skeptical of psychoanalysis, would probably agree, like, one of the big problems with something like Marx is that he doesn't have a very clear theory of mind. He doesn't have a very clear theory of individual actors beyond when he's making, you know, political polemics or talking very broadly about large class-based groups or political actors. And so I guess, how do you frame this idea of, I think you used the term transcendental materialism, and kind of how that maybe situates in what you're talking about there, with all those different kind of levels that interact with one another.
Yeah. And, you know, in fact, it might be most helpful to ease into this through, you know, at the start here, you made reference to Althusser. And, you know, I think that there's some things we can do with respect to him, you know, that sort of set up nicely, you know, an answer to your question about, well, you know, what sort of materialism exactly do I have in mind when I use the phrase transcendental materialism? And, you know, with Althusser, of course, it's also curious because you have a figure who was very influential for Lacan himself in terms of Lacan's understanding of Marxism, also for, you know, Žižek and his group in Slovenia. I mean, they in the 70s started off really as Althusserians, and it was through Althusserianism that they came to Lacan and came to be through Lacan, you know, with hindsight, somewhat dissatisfied with aspects of Althusser. And you're absolutely right that, you know, Althusser, it tends to be that when he talks about, when he speaks of subject, right? I mean, the word subject is very interesting because it can mean on the one hand, well, subject is subjectivity in the philosophical tradition, which tends to be associated with agency, autonomy, spontaneity, self-determination, reflective deliberation, etc., that we're subjects as it were, free agents. But of course, on the other sense of it, you know, if I say I'm subject to the crown, well, that's the opposite. That is, you know, I am beholden to some power or authority over me. I am heteronomous rather than autonomous. I am determined from outside rather than from within myself. And with Althusser, I mean, when Althusser says subject, he invariably means subject as subjected to, you know, some sort of authority, structure, etc., external to oneself. And that, of course, in perhaps his most famous single text, you know, the essay from the end of the 60s, Ideology and Ideological State Apparatuses, extracted from this unfinished manuscript on reproduction, that, you know, Althusser, you know, famously develops his theory of interpolation and how, you know, these different elements of social structure as ideological apparatuses hail or interpolate us, and in so doing, subject us to themselves, turn us into subjects qua subjected. And of course, with Lacan was very interested in preserving, I mean, although taking on board the full deterministic implications of psychoanalysis in terms of, you know, there is much that transpires below the threshold of explicit self-awareness that indeed runs the show, as it were, and that, you know, to some extent we are puppets or playthings of the unconscious. But, you know, nonetheless, for Lacan, there was still a sense in which there were aspects to our subjectivity where we remain subjects in the more classical philosophical sense, where there is a certain autonomy or agency that we enjoy, even admitting all of the deterministic implications of psychoanalysis or Marxism for that matter. And, you know, you might say Lacan is a kind of compatibilist who's seeking to integrate more deterministic and more voluntaristic perspectives in a single theory of subjectivity. With Althusser, then one of the things that Žižek through Lacan and, you know, also other Slovene Lacanians like Mladen Dolar do is to point out that, well, with Althusser, and especially when he talks about interpolation, there's a sense of the ideological machinery of social structure as cohesive, integrated, functioning smoothly, you know, able to serve as this almost godlike deterministic nexus. But of course, if, you know, we take seriously a Marxist account of social structure, well, social structures are shot through with inconsistencies, conflicts, you know, fragmentary factionalizations that make it such that with social structure, it's not as though you have this, in Lacanese, this unbarred big other, this, you know, fully integrated, some, you know, socio-symbolic order. You have instead this barred other as a field of structure that nonetheless is pervaded by inner antagonisms and discrepancies between its different elements and tensions between, you know, parts of itself. And the late Althusser, in the 1980s, little known, comes to register this belatedly. And then the idea is I can be hailed not only by a determining, functional, ideological state apparatus as a cohesive structure that is able to act in a deterministic fashion vis-a-vis me. I can also confront gaps in terms of places where there's irresolution, a lack of consensus, or a kind of a default in terms of social determination by virtue of being, you might say, hailed or interpolated by the inconsistencies in social structure. And that when that happens, I'm forced in a way to be free. You know, as Sartre would say, I'm momentarily condemned to freedom in terms of I have to then, since the system won't decide for me, I'm forced to decide in its place. And you get this idea of being able to be interpolated momentarily into a kind of autonomous subjectivity. And you can extract that from the very late Althusser, you know, especially with the benefit of a certain Lacanian perspective. And then you get this idea of, at the level of here, we're talking historical materialism in terms of human social structures and the subjects within them. But one of the things I do with transcendental materialism, and in this way running with the side of Marxism that, you know, seeks to develop not just a historical materialism, but a more ambitious general ontological framework, usually called dialectical materialism, you know, is to say that in a way, what holds for what I've just said about a kind of Lacano-Althusserian notion of how we can become free through being addressed, interpolated, hailed by inconsistencies in social structure that in a way force us into acting freely due to the default of determinism at those points. That arguably what holds for, you know, the conflict-ridden structure of human society, and here following Marx's wonderful line from the Gondresse, the anatomy of man is the key to the anatomy of the ape, that perhaps this also holds for pre- or non-human nature, that in a way, you know, instead of, you know, presupposing or positing that nature is this capital N, you know, godlike, seamless consistency, this sort of, you know, harmonious, self-integrated, cosmic organism writ large, et cetera. I mean, if you have an image of nature like that, in a way, you cannot in the end but, you know, in a sense, at least be in danger of lapsing into the crudest sort of scientistic reductionism where, you know, all that we can be is just, in a sense, you know, outgrowths or expressions of this one ultimate reality that is nature with a capital N. But what if, you know, what holds for, you know, the barred other of the dysfunctional socio-historical symbolic order holds also for nature? You know, what if nature is itself a conflict-ridden set of structures and dynamics, and the manner in which, in a way, the emergence of human beings and their distinctiveness, including, you know, having these societies that don't seem to be able to be reduced to anything natural, and that we do seem to come to enjoy a degree of agency that isn't just we're obeying the dictates of a wholly controlling natural causality. You know, how is it that nature, or we might say even more precisely, what do we have to, you know, looking back at the fact that we did emerge from nature, how must nature have been structured such that human beings could be produced out of it, given all of our peculiarities as we are made to appreciate by psychoanalysis, Marxism, et cetera? And I think that, you know, that side of dialectical materialism is really a key source of inspiration for what I'm interested in doing, which is indeed, yes, to ask, you know, how ultimately, how must we reconceive of nature itself so as to account for the fact that we emerged out of it, that we exist within it, but that we are arguably irreducible to it nonetheless, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, to take aspects that you get out of figures like Althusser and Lacan, and to be able to argue that this would hold not only for talking about human societies, their histories, et cetera, but that this might indeed provide insights into talking about pre and non-human nature and our place within that as well, at this larger level, which dialectical materialism as a tradition is very interested in.
One of the things that I think stands out in some of your work is precisely that kind of through this, you have engaged with questions of things like neurobiology, the life sciences. I think to some people, if you told them, oh, the psychoanalyst is really into this stuff, like they'd be a little bit confused because they see that as like totally, you know, antagonistic to one another. It's kind of analytical continental rift or what have you. And I realized I do have a copy of Self and Emotional Life, which you co-authored with Catherine Malibu, that I have to say, regrettably, has been sitting on my shelf, and I haven't gotten to it 6 billion other books. I skimmed a little bit of it just to see if I could maybe grab any interesting things before this conversation. And one bit in the introduction that I was kind of interested with, you're kind of both saying that Lacanian psychoanalysis has the capacity to integrate with a lot of this stuff, even if it does need also a bit of kind of self-criticism in terms of its failures to engage with it, or the people that kind of do try to kind of, you know, wall it off. But you have a section where you say when psychoanalysis is involved, at least at the level of kind of the brain itself and dealing with human behaviors or therapeutic things, that it has kind of four general things that it's dealing with. There's things that it can explain and treat, there's things it cannot explain but can treat, that it can explain but not treat, and things that it can't do either, which is kind of refreshing, honestly. I mean, Zizek mentions that there's, you know, this kind of tension between the therapeutic practice of psychoanalysis and the critico-theoretical level of psychoanalysis, as it's sometimes more broadly used. But it's a little bit refreshing because I'm not the biggest fan of Karl Popper, but you can kind of get that sense of, like, sometimes you're reading someone who's a psychoanalytical critical theorist type, and it's like, when do we say that maybe this is, you know, the psychoanalytic perspective is not the question that we need to be asking in this particular situation? I guess in some ways, I'm really getting to the more foundational question that I could have entered with, is kind of like, what do you think, if it's right to talk about like purposes or uses, how do you see like the kind of functional aim of psychoanalysis, or what it's really trying to get at? And do you have a kind of sense of when you're saying, you know, like, maybe this is a moment when we're not really going to need to talk at the level of, you know, Lacanian psychoanalysis. This is a level where, or a way of trying to figure out, maybe this can theoretically provide some explanatory power, if not adjust things. This is when it can adjust things, but maybe not explain it. Like, how do you kind of engage with those questions of avoiding it just being I can just apply it to anything and everything, and that some people might shy away from that being kind of a bugaboo in psychoanalytic theory.
Yeah. And I can begin by, you know, providing a little bit of background in terms of the history of this book that I co-authored with Malibu. For me, it involved primarily two things. First, intellectual digestion of a lot of what I had, been dealing with just a few years prior to writing it, because from 2002 through 2007, I was doing clinical psychoanalytic training, and I was in the process of, you know, really being immersed in the clinical side of psychoanalysis while I was at Emory's Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences in Atlanta, doing the training, and so some of it was a matter of really working through what I had learned from my clinical training, including my didactic analysis, that I underwent. And so that was one of the things that was really in the background of this book, and, you know, was an underlying sort of motivation, you know, for me to work on it. But then the other was, of course, this book was Malibu and I conceived as, you know, despite she and I having a lot in common intellectually, and, you know, sharing a set of convictions that, you know, really was responsible for us, deciding to do this work together. But at the same time, there are some major disagreements. And, you know, one of them was that, you know, Malibu has, repeatedly when engaging with psychoanalysis, wants to use certain things drawn from the realm of the neurosciences to argue that, you know, indeed, there are, especially with certain forms of neuropathology, there are these instances that show the explanatory limits and shortcomings of Freudian and Lacanian psychoanalysis. And, you know, for her, there was, I mean, in the background, there was a very personal factor here, which is that, she had to witness, had the very painful experience of witnessing her grandmother, in the long decline of Alzheimer's, which she eventually died of. Starting with, just this very intimate, exposure to the horrors of Alzheimer's as a neurodegenerative condition, wanting to argue that there are certain things like Alzheimer's, which psychoanalysis just has nothing to say in response to, and that this, and so much the worse for psychoanalysis. Whereas I feel, much less, threatened by such instances. And I believe that when you mentioned, my four categories, list of, all right, the things that psychoanalysis can both explain and treat, the things it can treat but not explain, that it can explain but not treat, and that it can neither explain nor treat. Malibu wants to say that fourth category, things it can neither explain nor treat, is quite large and poses, a real challenge to, the accuracy and the usefulness of psychoanalysis. Now, I think some of what the issue is that, especially in the French context, there are still vestiges in French clinical psychoanalysis as something which was much more the case in the early years of it at the start of the 20th century with Freud and his first followers, where initially there was this sense of, psychoanalysis, both theoretically and practically, both as a metapsychology and as a set of clinical techniques and practices, is a kind of all-terrain vehicle, in that it can, both explain and treat quite a wide range of things. In certain quarters of the French psychoanalytic world, you still have this sense of, analysis is early, optimism, or one might even say hubris, where it really saw itself as having this quite large scope, both explanatorily and therapeutically. But outside of those instances, especially in the more Anglo-American clinical universe that I was clinically trained in, that long ago ceased to be part of analyst sensibilities, and that there are debates about what is called width or narrowness of scope. And certain analysts will, for instance, they'll be willing to take into analysis, say, someone who is diagnosed with bipolar disorder, someone who is considered to be quote unquote borderline personality, which often is just a rough way of saying, all right, really neurotic, almost psychotic, but not entirely psychotic. That few of any analysts, that I can think of who are, still clinically practicing, actually seeing patients, would ever think of taking into analysis and trying to treat analytically someone diagnosed with Alzheimer's or severe schizophrenia, or, in fact, you're even trained, when you're being formed as an analyst, as a clinician, at least in the English speaking world, as a non-MD, since I didn't have an MD in psychiatry, I had to get all this extra training. And one of the things I had to learn to do in terms of psychodiagnostics was to be able to spot individuals who I should refer to non-analytic practitioners, up to and including, all right, there are things that can look like they are psychopathologies that are actually symptomatic of a brain tumor or, some organic dysfunction where you need to send them to a somatic medicine specialist, not somebody who's a mental health practitioner. So for me, with cases like Alzheimer's, I could say to Malibu, okay, sure. There's very little that analysis has to offer in terms of, especially treating, but even, theoretically trying to explain Alzheimer's and its symptoms. But then there are cases that are trickier, like schizophrenia, right? Where, you know, we do, it, you know, with schizophrenia, yes, there's clearly an underlying biological component. I mean, in the fact that, among other things, it has a definite age of onset for men and women, and, you know, with men, late teens through 20s, women slightly older, but there's definitely like a chronological age window for the initial surfacing of the condition. And that, moreover, it seems to strike in a way where it doesn't matter, say, whether you had a good or bad childhood, what sorts of past experiences you had, et cetera. It can strike down someone all of a sudden who had an utterly idyllic upbringing, etc., no previous problems, and they can all of a sudden, you know, be floridly psychotic thanks to schizophrenia. But here, this is one where I don't think it's that, like Alzheimer's, it's something where you might say, okay, analysis can neither treat nor, you know, has any explanatory value with respect to it. Because if you look at, like, if you're dealing with forms of schizophrenia, for instance, that have hallucinatory or delusional content, right? The biology doesn't fully explain that. You can say, well, yes, there's an underlying biological trigger, but the way in which you know, certain symptoms will be constructed thanks to that biological trigger, the manner in which, you know, a whole like delusional belief system, or, you know, certain, you know, auditory or visual hallucinatory content will take shape. Well, that's going to differ from person to person. I mean, you know, each you know, hallucinating or delusional schizophrenic will have their own particular, you know, content in terms of those symptoms. And analysis, I think, is actually very helpful for trying to explain, okay, why does this person with their life history, et cetera, have these particular delusions or hallucinations rather than, you know, other you know, contents that one would see in, you know, similar schizophrenic patients. Mm-hmm. And there, I think analysis can explain quite a bit, and sometimes can even provide some partial therapeutic alleviation, although, you know, the idea of just trying to use analysis alone to treat somebody who's floridly schizophrenic would be, you know, unethical, you know, completely irresponsible, but it doesn't, it's not that it has nothing to offer. And so I think, you know, there, you know, Malibu takes this very extreme position, which seems to me too all or nothing, and to say, all right, schizophrenics, you know, Alzheimer's patients, et cetera, you know, the psychoanalysis is problematic because it can, you know, neither say nor do anything relevant to these sorts of cases. And I, you know, as you might have gathered, I really disagreed with her on that and pushed back against it. And then when it comes to, if we're talking about not psychopathology, but to come back to some of your earlier line of questioning, psychoanalysis vis-a-vis, you know, sociocultural phenomena. You know, here again, I think that, you know, it's, you know, psychoanalysis usually, I mean, when we're talking about sociocultural phenomena, I think it invariably has some useful things to say. But I think even just at the theoretical level, I think by itself, it's rarely, you know, entirely sufficient, and hence the turn to things like Marxism and, you know, to bring in other components that psychoanalysis by itself might not give you as a tool for theorizing sociocultural phenomena. But then in terms of treatment, I mean, it's hard to, you know, since psychoanalysis is, you know, in part given its bourgeois origins in turn of the century Vienna with Freud and the particular cultural ethos he inhabited, you know, of course, it's a very private, intimate, individual affair. You know, there's no such thing as, like, you know, mass scale, not just group, but, like, you know, the level of society, you know, mass scale treatment, mm-hmm. you know, through psychoanalysis. You know, and of course, also one of Freud's relatives, you know, was one of the founding figures in the advertising industry, and in fact, was able to turn psycho. Yeah, so, you know, it can be abused too, as far as some of that goes. But yeah, and neither when talking about clinical matters nor when talking about, you know, theory beyond just the domain of individual psychopathology, I'm certainly not a proponent of psychoanalysis as the be-all and end-all, sole, unique, you know, theoretical and practical framework for dealing with everything under the sun. But, you know, once you get let go of that, I think it becomes easier to respond to things like something like Malibu's critique, you know, and, you know, and to be able to say, look, you're kind of kicking down an open door. You know, there are some cases that nobody, I think, who is a responsible analytic clinician would ever think of putting on the couch. But there are some cases where you wouldn't put them in analysis as your favorite mode of treatment, but that doesn't mean analysis doesn't have some insight, some, you know, explanatory power vis-a-vis some of what's involved in those cases.
We're almost done out of time here. So I guess I'll close up with just kind of one of the things that I usually end with, which is just sort of saying, you know, I'm sure that we get a lot of listeners who don't have the time to like read along with all of our books and or know a whole ton about the theorists that we're talking about and things. So if you were to say, you know, oh, someone's interested in Lacanian psychoanalysis, someone's interested in Zizek, someone's interested in transcendental materialism, and they're trying to find an accessible way of getting into this, where do you think would be a good place for them to begin? Are there any misreadings or misconceptions that you think people encounter early on you'd like to counteract? I suspect you're going to say, do not start getting your copy of, I don't know the French pronunciation, Écrits, and diving in right there. But I guess how would you maybe say, like, this is a good place to start seeing like what the potentials of these questions and things are, even if you're maybe someone who's not going to go on to become a psychoanalytic clinician or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, here, apropos starting with the Lacan, I feel a little awkward doing this, but a number of years ago, I was commissioned by the editors of the online Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy to put together the entry on Lacan for them. Nice. I will say, as I started writing it, I immediately regretted saying yes, you know, because the format is you have, you know, roughly 10,000 words, and the idea is, all right, covering this figure from beginning to end, you know, basically in the space of a single essay, more or less, try and distill out everything important in Lacan's corpus and his intellectual itinerary. You know, that's a massive undertaking for not only dealing with Lacan, but any figure of that sort. And so it's easier to write a book. I mean, if you're like, okay, you have 100,000 words, write a book, you know, summarizing Lacan, that would still be hard, but it's much harder doing it in just 10,000 words. But anyhow, I agonized over this. And in the end, I was not unhappy with the result. And this is, if you Google Jacques Lacan, I think it now just pops up as the first hit on Google. And it's a freely available thing online. And it's my best effort at providing, and this is meant to be a resource that, for instance, you know, undergraduate students can, you know, turn to online when they're just beginning to get to grips with, you know, a new figure, orientation, set of ideas. And, you know, the Stanford Encyclopedia is a wonderful resource in general. If those interested in just beginning to get their bearings apropos Lacan, well, you can pull up my entry on him, the Stanford Encyclopedia online for free. And that also has a bibliography at the end of both primary and secondary source literature. And there's some very good material out there. For instance, I think in English, one of the best introductions to Lacan as a single book is Bruce Fink's 1995 text, The Lacanian Subject Between Language and Jouissance. You know, there, and the resources like that are listed in the bibliography. So that's one place to begin. And it's true, reading Lacan himself, I mean, there's even a joke in France that he requires subtitling in his native tongue. You know, apart from translation issues into English, yeah, I mean, Lacan is maddeningly obscure and difficult initially. And, you know, learning Lacanian theory in terms of dealing with the primary source material is, even if you're reading it in translation, like learning a new language. But I believe it is well worth the payoff if one decides to really invest in that. So that's, you know, just a beginning recommendation apropos Lacan. You know, start with this online encyclopedia entry, and you can follow leads from there and go as far as you want. And, you know, Zizek himself is very helpful in terms of explaining Lacan. I mean, he has works like, you know, for instance, Enjoy Your Symptom or Looking Awry from the early 90s, which are, you know, initial versions of his popularizing explanations of Lacan, you know, via contemporary culture and current events. And, you know, more recently, he wrote a short book entitled How to Read Lacan. You know, and he's also, I think, a very clear writer as well. So, you know, those are resources that are helpful too. In terms of what I call transcendental materialism, I mean, the first place where I developed this as a way of capturing some of what's essential to Zizek's work is this 2008 book of mine, Zizek's Ontology, Transcendental Materialist Theory of Subjectivity. You know, that's like the initial kind of articulation of this by looking at Zizek's Lacanian appropriations of Kant, Schelling, and Hegel in particular. And then with Zizek himself, so in 2012, he published, I mean, of course, it's very long, but it's still quite readable. He published this hulking 1,000-page tome, Less Than Nothing, Hegel and the Shadow of Dialectical Materialism. And I remember in the years leading up to it, it was clear that this was just his consuming passion was working on this project. And, you know, a lot of expectation built up around it. People were really waiting for this to come out. I was thinking to myself, all right, you know, there's so much hype that has accumulated around it. Will it live up to expectations? And I would actually say it did. I really think it's a masterpiece and is a wonderful, I mean, I hate to say condensed, about 1,000-page book, but it's in a way this wonderful kind of, you know, a condensation of Zizek's work on German idealism, Marxism, and psychoanalysis, you know, that he had been pursuing since the 1980s. And if you wanted to just have like a kind of one-stop initial shop for things Zizekian, you know, in the vein that we've been talking about, I think that 2012 book is a great place to start. And, you know, obviously you would have to be pretty committed to read the whole thing cover to cover, but, you know, you could start by, you know, reading certain portions of it and taking it from there. And I think it itself is a wonderful point of entry into, I think, the more serious philosophical theoretical side of Zizek.
It's been great having the opportunity to talk with you. I really hope that listeners found this to be a great conversation. I really appreciate your clarity and your willingness to just kind of like get into the meat of these things, because it's certainly given me a lot to think about. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much. I had a great time talking with you.
That's our bonus episode. Apologies to those who are waiting for our episodes. This was intended to be, you know, the November bonus episode. It did get a little bit late just because we recorded our main standard reading group episode and this bonus episode rather late in the month. So it's coming out on the very start of December instead. But we should still get our normal monthly episode for December out this month. So thank you if you've been waiting patiently for this to drop. We hope you enjoyed our discussion, and our next book should be Signs Taken for Wonders, which is by Franco Moretti. And if you haven't listened to it yet, by the time this is out, then we still have our Gillian Rose discussion going up, which is on sexuality in the field of vision. So a little bit more Lacanian psychoanalysis there. So thank you for listening, and we hope you'll join us next time.